I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more important works of investigative reporting is the basis of a new book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Canadian journalist Judy Reaver has followed the story since 1997 and in the 21 years since has talked to over 200 RPF defectors of the Paul Kagame regime in Rwanda, as well as survivors of the atrocities and former soldiers. She has documents leaked from the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and in this book has a complete history of the Rwandan genocide. The international community considers Kagame's RPF as the saviors who ended the Hutu slaughter of the Tutsis, but we see now just how ruthless they were and how he and his top commanders planned and covered their tracks. Judy Reaver is a freelance print and broadcast journalist who started her career with Radio France International before working for Agence France-Presse, reporting from Africa and the Middle East. Her reporting on Rwanda has been featured in 7 front-page stories in the Globe and Mail over the past 4 years. Her work has also appeared in Foreign Policy Journal, Le Monde Diplomatique, Humanosphere, Digital Journal, and the Africa Report. She has been named an expert on Rwanda by the Rights in Exile program. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program in Montreal, Judy Reaver. Ms. Reaver, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So I've had General Dallaire on the show before, and you know, as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking we don't think of what's happening in Africa enough. I mean, we tend to think after, say, like his time there, the atrocities stop. And your book tells us, no, that a lot of myths have persisted, you know, that it is an incomplete story. Why has it been that way for so long?
Well, it's stark. We've seen so much conflict and suffering in the last 25 years in Central Africa. We've heard part of it. But there has been, unfortunately, an attempt, a successful attempt, to cover up a lot of the perpetrators, the record, and how we understand the past and how we understand the present. Mm-hmm. Because what's happening today is a feedback loop. Unfortunately, the repression and the systematic human rights abuses we're seeing is a result of, to some extent, not dealing with the problems and the crimes that were committed even before the Rwandan genocide and during the Rwandan genocide. So hopefully my book looks at that, and a very good there's a subtext to my book, and it's really and this answers hopefully the question to some extent, is how states have denied access to information in the aftermath of violence and how devastating that is.
Yeah, and so see, I mean, for aspiring journalists especially, I think this book will prove wise and helpful in that regard, in terms of uncovering what you've been able to uncover. And so for you, I mean, you've covered this story now. I guess the first time you went there, was that 1997? Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I went to cover the humanitarian crisis.
Yeah.
After Mobutu was toppled, and that's just after the Rwandan army had invaded and toppled Mobutu Sese Seko. I went in immediately after, in May 1997, and that's when hundreds of thousands of Congolese and Rwandan Hutu refugees had been displaced during the war. I wanted to follow their stories.
Yeah, and so it's a story that you've covered for, I guess, over 20 years now. When was it that you first uncovered what you did about Kagame and his regime that people didn't know heretofore?
Well, what happened is back then I was a much younger journalist, and I was able to the nature of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is Kagame's regime.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that by going into the jungle south of Kisangani in Congo, northeastern Congo. I went by boat, and then I went through the forest with a group of Congolese aid workers. And it was a very difficult trip. We went on a number of trips, but what we were looking for were survivors of attacks. These were refugees and other Congolese who had been attacked by the Rwandan army. So it was during that trip and during other visits to transit camps in Congo as a young person, as a young journalist with these Congolese aid workers, that I saw what the Rwandan army under Kagame was capable of, what they did. And that was diametrically opposed to the stories we were hearing at the time, which was Kagame and his army were the moral victors of the genocide.
Right.
They were going to be the agents of an African renaissance. We had these incredible features that were eloquently written in magazines like The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And we had also in Canada a fairly, I would say, positive coverage of Kagame and his political party in the aftermath of the genocide. The spin on it was that he was resurrecting the country from the ashes.
And so what you've been able to see over the last 20 years on the ground, that was not the case.
It wasn't the case. And what had happened was the atrocities that were actually documented, the atrocities by his army that were documented by the United Nations and even before that by aid workers and
uh-huh.
other human rights organizations, those crimes were never prosecuted by an international tribunal. They were never dealt with. They were never dealt with for all kinds of geopolitical reasons. And they, because he was not managed or he was not prosecuted, that enabled him to support militias for the next 20 years in the Congo. And what we've seen is a plethora of conflict that has raged off and on and that is still raging. In fact, we have 4.5 million people who are displaced still in Congo. The particular hotbed of areas in Congo right now are the Kasai region in central Congo. And it's been devastating. We have millions of people who have died because of the violence or war-related diseases. So this is very serious.
Yeah.
The lack of justice and then all the problems, social and the violence that has precipitated because of,
yeah.
of the situation we haven't dealt with.
Yeah, and it's something that we, well, in this country need to think about as well, because I think our government supports the regime but through aid, doesn't it?
We've given, Canada has given since genocide about half, well, actually more than $500 million in aid.
Mm-hmm.
And more recently, that aid hasn't been directly to the government, but more through social programs and health projects. But still, we have dealt with and supported this government politically since the genocide. Mr. Kagame comes here and is treated very well. More recently, in recent years, he's been invited to the Toronto Club. He's met with Mr. Dallaire. He always is. He gets royal, the red carpet
yeah.
treatment. Most recently, General Dallaire helped the UN and the Canadian government organize a major peacekeeping conference in Vancouver. That was in November 2017. And Kagame's defense minister, James Kabarebe, was invited.
Mm.
And he met with our defense minister. James Kabarebe was the leading commander of the Rwandan troops that went into the Congo, and these troops have been accused of possibly committing genocide by the United Nations. No tribunal has ever thoroughly launched criminal charges against Mr. Kabarebe, but this is a man against whom an indictment has been issued by Spain. There are an enormous amount of, an overwhelming amount of accusations and evidence against this man, and he meets our defense minister, and he's invited by General Dallaire. It's shocking.
Yeah, it is. And that's gone on for 20 years. I mean, you think of figures like Clinton and Tony Blair, and even in the previous American government, President Obama, I don't know how to put it, but just a sort of a brush off of Kagame and whatever they might have done. And so what do you think explains that, and why these figures in the West especially have been propagating the history that we sort of have come to, I don't know, agree with or just accept?
Well, it's astonishing. It keeps me up at night, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, this is realpolitik, I have to say. There are geopolitical reasons behind this.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you that I fully understand the machinations and why we support people who have committed so many human rights abuses and inflamed the region, stoked conflict for nearly three decades. You would have to ask them, but the point is that these powerful insiders have covered up these crimes. They've worked to hide the crimes. We look at how you mentioned Bill Clinton, who issued what appeared to be a heartfelt apology in the aftermath of the genocide, saying he wished the United States was able to do more. He didn't realize what was happening and when.
Right.
Well, in fact, Samantha Power points this out in a book that she wrote. The United States worked actively and aggressively not to intervene during the Rwandan genocide. The United States had all the satellites at its disposal. To understand what was happening in Hutu-controlled zones and in Kagame's army in zones controlled by Rwandan Patriotic Front and army zones. So that means it understands, it has the evidence, if it wanted to bring to a court. But it has protected Kagame. So in some ways, and in the same way, I think, you know, you'd have to read my book fully, but you see the level of support, the way the United States greenlit the invasion of Zaire because it wanted to topple Mobutu. It wanted to open up Zaire for business. The world economy starts in Congo, copper, cobalt, all the mineral resources that we need to use in aeronautics and electronics and in battery-operated cars. That starts there. So part of the story, part of the reasons are the economy. Other reasons are these are our friends, and no matter what they do, we will support them, even if they kill our own people.
Yeah. And so do you think there's a change afoot in terms of how Kagame and his regime is viewed by the larger world community? Because, the figures that I mentioned a moment ago, Clinton, Blair, Obama, are a lot different, say, than in worldview, than, let's say, President Trump and the sort of leadership that we're seeing emerge in the world today. I mean, is there a change in how does the future of the Kagame regime look to you at this point?
I think the regime is in trouble because we've had more of a concerted effort among human rights organizations to look at what's happening inside the country. I think now it's reached a point because Rwanda has meddled for so many years in the Congo, and Congo is now, you know, just for so many years it was on fire and bleeding. We now realize that, but more importantly, I think the regime is embarrassing to the United States, and the fact that Kagame last year, 2 years ago, changed the constitution, and last year ensured that he won a third term. I think all of these things make the United States' support of the regime more tenuous and more difficult. So, and that combined with human rights reports, even by the State Department. I think it's just more difficult to actively support this regime and maintain this idea that he was the one holding Rwanda together.
Yeah.
Even if the capital, Kigali, looks good and things run well. So, you know, a lot of people say it's a house of cards. I don't know. I think, you know, we'll have to see going forward. But I haven't seen any particular change in policy toward Rwanda or toward Kagame. What we've seen more openly with Trump is that he speaks his mind. And, you know, that's often a scary thing. But recently when he met President Kagame, President Kagame is now the head of the African Union, he said that he was very eager to maintain close ties, and Rwanda was a great friend to the United States. So there's no change in policy in the immediate future, anyhow.
Now, let's say the regime is toppled and Kagame is deposed. However, that may happen. I mean, what fills the vacuum, if you will, in terms of the future of Rwanda? Have you got a sense of that, and what might happen?
I don't really. A lot of people are predicting another round of violence.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't happen.
Mm.
I think that there's various groups on the outside, abroad, that have tried to work together, opposition forces and opposition activists, people interested in democracy, people interested in institutions. I assume that they'll become actively involved, but certainly the ethnic divisions in Rwanda are acute. They have festered terribly since the genocide, and none of the reconciliation that I think the development community and diplomats and you know mainstream academics possibly and politicians have talked about, none of the reconciliation process and real justice measures have been taken. So what that means for the future of Rwanda is really, it's an open question.
No, a lot of the book talks about the stuff that you've been able to uncover over the years. I mentioned in the introduction, of course, that you know, your work as a journalist has resulted in front page stories in the Globe and Mail and elsewhere. A lot of these documents that you got, they were leaked to you. I guess they were presented to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Is that right?
Yes, a number of the most pertinent documents that were really illuminating to me were came from something called the Special Investigations Unit of the UN International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Now, that was the court that was set up in the aftermath of the genocide to investigate and prosecute alleged perpetrators of the most serious crime.
Had that body concluded its investigation at the time that you received the documents?
Well, in fact, I was leaked a number of those documents in 2015.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, basically the tribunal was wrapping up by then, and the special investigations unit had long stopped working. So the results and the summary documents that I got access to that were leaked to me were from investigations dating years and years before, like around 2001 and 2002 and 2003. So one of the documents dated 2003. There was another document that's very interesting and revealing, dating from 2005.
Uh-huh.
And I got a whole series of exculpatory information, or evidence, rather, from trials, so from a number of different sources. So, and all of those trials were ongoing until fairly recently. But most of this is really from the years 2000 to 2010.
Uh-huh.
But the tribunal itself has, it wrapped up in 2000, it wrapped up a few years ago, and there's just some residual cases that are being completed now.
So what does that tell you about this tribunal, organizations like the United Nations, and what they've been, what they haven't done in terms of this regime and Kagame himself?
Well, they...
I mean, I read this. I read this book, Judy, and I think to myself, I don't have a lot of faith in organizations like that, and you know, tribunals, bodies like that. I mean, is how I feel. Is that how a lot of people have felt that you've talked to, say?
Well, I don't have a lot of faith in the United Nations' ability to bring about justice. And why? It's because the United Nations, the Security Council, has played politics.
Mm.
And the West has steered that process. So what we have, if we just take a second and look at the tribunal, we've spent upwards of $2 billion. And that tribunal was largely political because there was enormous malfeasance at the tribunal and a miscarriage of justice in that it prosecuted one side of the Rwandan genocide and actually perpetrated and propagated this idea that only one side was guilty of mm-hmm. atrocities. And so we have about 60, a little bit more than 60 convictions people convicted of genocide and lesser crimes, and they were all associated with the former Hutu regime. Not one person was tried and convicted who was linked to Kagame. So the upshot of that, the result is that Kagame has gotten off scot-free. The tribunal actually cemented his impunity and reinforced his ethnic dictatorship, under which, you know, millions of people are suffering today.
The book, as I hope we've been able to establish in our conversation for people listening, it's a marvelous book in terms of how you chronicle the sources that you have and how you cultivate those sources over time. And obviously what you've yielded from them. For people listening, without giving too much away in terms of how you work, and how have you found it in terms of talking to people that you have and getting the information that you've been able to get? I mean, there's a lesson here for people in terms of how to get people to talk to you.
Well, it's been a long process. Investigative journalism takes so many years. It depends on the story you're looking for. But there was a lot of data mining, of course. Initially, I was focused on victims, finding victims, and I found a lot of contextual witnesses to crimes, people who were fleeing and who could talk about the, you know, the whole terrain and why they were fleeing and having lost family members. Then I moved to another level of evidence, which was direct witnesses of crimes. So, initially I found people in the transit camps and in the camps in the jungle who had been direct witnesses. And in some cases, some of the Congolese aid workers were direct witnesses. They'd seen things that were incredible. But there was still a gap in my research. And to be honest, I did this over a long period of time and also had another job. I was a journalist. I was a freelance journalist working on local news at times. The final stage of my work, in a way, was, there were two aspects to the final stage. I realized to understand the dynamics of crimes committed by Kagame's army and his regime, I'd have to go inside somehow and infiltrate his people who had fled. And there were enough of them. And you really simply start out by accessing one or two initially, and they lead you to others. The story is really, like, there's no one source that could give me access to everything. It was one introducing, you know, telling me what he knew in his area of operations, and then he led me to others, and others led me to others. So it was very incremental. At the same time, there are many people, even Canadians, who have worked at the tribunal, and I just called and contacted and emailed everyone I could think of who had any experience at the tribunal, and that would have been like from lawyers to clerks to investigators. It's work over, you know, many, many years.
Yeah, it's 20 years, over 20 years, yeah. What, yeah. One gets a sense reading the book, you know, the personal risk as well. The stuff that you've seen, the violence, the evil that you've seen, I mean, how have you, I guess, dealt with that? I mean, how has it affected you, if at all? I mean, it's got to, right?
Well, it's affected me on a physical level, I think, various stages in my research. I point out that the Rwandan regime, which has been lauded and applauded for its governance, it's tried to stop me from reporting on this. So I got a lot of warnings, intimidation, harassment, some physical traps they laid for me. Throughout, I tried to, there were a lot of missteps on my part, but I did try to report on this incrementally. But then I realized that if I was going to finish the work, I had to be quiet. So that's what I did. I kept my head down, and there were many times where I realized that maybe I should stop because there were threats against my family, and I could no longer travel. It got to a point in 2014 where I had gone to Belgium to meet with many sources, and I was met at a hotel in Brussels by Belgian Secret Service, state security personnel, and they said we've been mandated to protect you because the Rwandan embassy in Belgium constitutes a threat to your life. Mm-hmm. And so this was extraordinary to me that it had reached a point where I could be physically assaulted in a hotel or at an interview that I had set up. And so I was guarded by, you know, a team of security guards and was driven around in armored Mercedes. It was really quite extraordinary. I think it's an unusual situation, but it just requires, it required me to think differently about the kind of work I was doing and how I was going to do it. But at one point, I had to go public with these threats, and this was not something that the people who were helping me, authorities who were providing security for me and following my case, like the provincial police and local police and even CSIS that was meeting with me to assess my security situation, they were troubled, actually, at the fact that, you know, this was happening, but also that I was going to speak about this publicly because it makes it more difficult for them to monitor my case. But I needed to warn the Rwandan government that if they were going to do something, strike against me, then they would be the first suspect.
Right, right, yeah. This is a book, Judy, that one can't easily forget, and I so appreciate your time today to talk about it, and congratulations on it, and good luck with it and everything else.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you contacting me and your interest in this.
The book is called In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. It's published by Random House. Judy Reaver, its author, joined me on the line from Montreal and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.